Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Scientists are starting to understand that pain can be generated without a specific triggering injury, which is good news for all the people who were ignored or ridiculed for complaining of pain without a pathology obvious to their doctor. It turns out that pain is a very complex and subjective phenomenon that is shaped by each person's individual nervous system. Today, we will read from the January 2020 National Geographic Wellness Issue. The article is titled A World of Pain and is written by Yudhijit Bhattacharjee, who's an award-winning writer whose features and essays on espionage, cybercrime, science, and medicine have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, Wired, and other U.S. magazines. And we'll jump right in here. More than three decades ago, when Tom Norris was fighting cancer, he underwent radiation therapy on his groin and his left hip. His cancer disappeared and hasn't come back. But Norris was left with a piercing ache that burned from his hip up his spine to his neck. Since then, Norris, now 70, has never had a single day free from pain. It cut short his career as an aircraft maintenance officer in the U.S. Air Force. It's been his constant companion, like the cane he uses to walk. On bad days, the pain is so excruciating he's bedridden. Even on the best days, it severely limits his ability to move about, preventing him from doing the simplest chores, like taking out the garbage. Sometimes the pain is so overpowering, Norris says, that his breathing becomes labored. It's like I'm drowning. Norris, who lives in a Los Angeles suburb, spoke to me from a long cushioned bench, which allowed him to go from sitting to lying flat on his back. A tall and genial man, he's become adept at wearing a mask of serenity to hide his pain. I never saw him wince. When his agony is especially intense, his wife of 31 years, Marianne, says she can tell by a certain stillness she sees in his eyes. When the pain began to take over his life, Norris sought solace in speaking out. He became an advocate for chronic pain sufferers and started a support group. And for 30 years, he has searched for relief. For many of those years, he was on fentanyl, a powerful opioid that he says covered his pain like a thick blanket, but kept him basically horizontal and zoned out. He has tried acupuncture, which was somewhat helpful, as well as bee stings, magnet therapy, and faith healing, which weren't. Norris now manages his pain with physical therapy, which improves his mobility, and steroids injected into his spine, which quiet his inflamed nerves. Like Norris, nearly 50 million people in the United States and millions more around the world live with chronic pain. The causes are diverse, from cancer to diabetes to neurological illnesses and other ailments, but they share a common source of suffering: physical agony that disrupts their lives intermittently or all the time. It's not uncommon for cancer patients experiencing severe, unrelenting pain after chemotherapy to opt out of treatment in favor of the ultimate salve of dying. The toll exacted by chronic pain has become increasingly visible in recent years. After doctors in the late 1990s began prescribing opioid medications such as oxycodone to alleviate persistent pain, hundreds of thousands of Americans developed an addiction to these drugs, which sometimes produce feelings of pleasure in addition to easing pain. Even after the risks became evident, the reliance on opioids continued, in part because there were few alternatives. No novel blockbuster painkillers have been developed in the past couple of decades. The misuse of opioid pain relievers, which are ideally suited for short-term management of acute pain, has become rampant across the United States. In 2017, an estimated 1.7 million Americans had a substance abuse disorder stemming from having been prescribed opioids, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. Every day in the U.S., about 130 people die from opioid overdoses, a grim statistic that includes deaths from prescription painkillers as well as narcotics like heroin. The quest to understand the biology of pain and find more effective ways to manage chronic pain has taken on fresh urgency. Researchers are making significant strides in detailing how pain signals are communicated from sensory nerves to the brain and how the brain perceives the sensation of pain. Scientists also are uncovering the roles that specific genes play in regulating pain, which is helping to explain why the perception and tolerance of pain vary so widely. These advances are radically altering how clinicians and scientists view pain, specifically chronic pain, defined as pain that lasts more than 3 months. Medical science traditionally regarded pain as a consequence of injury or disease, secondary to its root cause. In many patients, it turns out, pain originating from an injury or ailment persists long after the underlying cause has been resolved. Pain in such cases becomes the disease. The hope is that this insight, coupled with the steadily advancing understanding of pain, will lead to new therapies for chronic pain, including non-addictive alternatives to opioids. Norris and other patients are keen to see those breakthroughs happen. Researchers, meanwhile, are testing promising alternative strategies, such as stimulating the brain with mild electric shocks to alter its pain perception and harnessing the body's intrinsic capacity to soothe its own pain. Clifford Wolfe, a neurobiologist at Children's Hospital in Boston, who's studied pain for more than 4 decades, says it's tragic it has taken a societal catastrophe for pain to get the attention it deserves from scientists and physicians. But the impetus this has given to pain research is a silver lining. I think we have the potential in the next few years of really making an enormous impact in our understanding of pain, he says, and that will definitely contribute to new treatment options. The capacity to feel pain is one of nature's gifts to mankind and the rest of the animal kingdom. Without it, we wouldn't reflexively recoil our hand upon touching a hot stove or know to avoid walking barefoot over broken glass. Those actions, motivated by an immediate or remembered experience of pain, help us minimize the risk of bodily injury. We evolved to feel pain because the sensation serves as an alarm system that is key to self-preservation. The sentries in this system are a special class of sensory neurons called nociceptors, which sit close to the spine, with their fibers extending into the skin, the lungs, the gut, and other parts of the body. They're equipped to sense different kinds of harmful stimuli. A knife's cut, the heat of molten wax, the burn of acid. When nociceptors detect any of these threats, they send electrical signals to the spinal cord, which transmits them via other neurons to the brain. Higher order neurons in the cortex, the final destination of this ascending pain pathway, translate this input into the perception of pain. Upon registering the pain, the brain attempts to counteract it. Neural networks in the brain send electrical signals down the spinal cord along what's known as the descending pain pathway, triggering the release of endorphins and other natural opioids. These biochemicals inhibit ascending pain signals, effectively reducing the amount of pain perceived. Scientists had sketched out this basic schematic of ascending and descending pain pathways when Wolfe began working in the field in the 1980s. A soft-spoken man with eyes that seemed to brim with kindness, Wolfe was struck by the plight of patients he saw in the surgery ward when he was pursuing his medical degree. It was clear that all were suffering from severe pain, he says. Wolfe felt the senior resident surgeon seemed almost resentful that they were complaining. I said to the surgeon, "Why aren't you doing anything?" Wolfe recalls. And the surgeon said, "Well, what do you expect? They just had an operation. They'll get better." Pain was a problem the medical profession downplayed to a substantial extent because there was no safe and effective interventions, Wolfe says. This realization kindled his desire to understand the nature of pain. Using rats as a model, he set out to learn more about how pain is transmitted. In his experiments, Wolf recorded the activity of neurons in the animal's spinal cords in response to a brief application of heat to their skin. As he expected, he observed these neurons firing excitedly when signals arrived from the nociceptive neurons. But Wolf made an unexpected finding. After a patch of skin subjected to heat a few times became inflamed, the neurons in the spinal cord attained a heightened state of sensitivity. Merely stroking the area surrounding the previously injured patch caused them to fire. This showed that the injury to the skin had sensitized the central nervous system, causing neurons in the spinal cord to transmit pain signals to the brain, even when the input from peripheral nerves was innocuous. Other researchers have since demonstrated this phenomenon, called central sensitization in humans, and shown that it drives various types of pain, such as when the area around a cut or a burn hurts at the slightest touch. A startling conclusion from Wolf's work and subsequent research was that pain could be generated in the absence of a triggering injury. This challenged the view held by some doctors that patients who complained of pain that couldn't be explained by any obvious pathology were likely lying for one reason or another. To get painkillers they didn't need, perhaps, or to gain sympathy. The pain transmission system can become hypersensitive in the wake of an injury, which is what happened in the rats. But it also can go haywire on its own or stay in a sensitized state well after an injury is healed. This is what happens in patients with neuropathic pain, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, and certain other conditions. Their pain is not a symptom, it's a disease, one caused by a malfunctioning nervous system. With advances in growing human stem cells in the lab, Wolf and his colleagues are now creating different types of human neurons, including nociceptors. This breakthrough is allowing them to study neurons in greater detail than was previously possible to determine the circumstances where they become pathologically excitable, Wolf says, and fire spontaneously. Wolf and his colleagues have used lab-grown nociceptors to investigate why chemotherapy drugs cause neuropathic pain. When the nociceptors are exposed to these drugs, they become more easily triggered and begin to degenerate. This likely contributes to the neuropathies that 40% of chemotherapy patients endure. While scientists like Wolf are advancing the understanding of how pain is transmitted, other scientists have discovered that these signals are just one factor in how the brain perceives pain. Pain, it turns out, is a complex, subjective phenomenon that is shaped by the particular brain that's experiencing it. How pain signals are ultimately translated into painful sensations can be influenced by a person's emotional state. The context in which the pain is being perceived also can alter how it feels, as evidenced by the pleasantness of the aches that follow a strenuous workout, or the desire for a second helping of a spicy dish, despite the punishing sting it delivers to the tongue. You've got this incredible capability of altering how those signals are processed when they do arrive, says Irene Tracy, a neuroscientist at the University of Oxford. A skilled communicator who speaks in rapid-fire sentences, Tracy has spent much of her career trying to bridge the mysterious link between injury and pain. This is a highly non-linear relationship, and many things can make it worse, or can make it better, or can make it very different, she says. In experiments, Tracy and her colleagues have imaged the brains of human volunteers while subjecting their skin to pinpricks or bursts of heat or smears of cream laced with capsaicin, the chemical compound that makes chili peppers spicy. What the researchers have found has led them to discover a much more complex picture of pain perception than had been previously envisioned. There's no single pain center in the brain. Instead, multiple regions are activated in response to painful stimuli, including networks that also are involved in emotion, cognition, memory, and decision-making. They also learned that the same stimulus doesn't produce the same activation pattern every time, indicating that a person's experience of pain can vary even when the injuries are similar. This flexibility serves us well, raising our pain tolerance in situations that demand it. For instance, when carrying a scorching bowl of soup from the microwave to the kitchen counter. The mind knows that dropping the bowl midway would result in greater misery than the brief anguish caused by holding the bowl, so it tolerates the momentary suffering. Tracy and her colleagues have shown that fear, anxiety, and sadness can make pain feel worse. In one of their experiments, healthy student volunteers listened to Prokofiev's deeply melancholic Russia Under the Magnolian Yoke, slowed to half speed, and read negative statements such as, "My life is a failure." At the same time, they received a burst of heat on a patch on their left forearm, which had been rubbed with capsaicin. Later, the students received the same stimulus as they listened to happier music and read neutral statements such as, "Cherries are fruits." In the sad condition, they reported finding the pain more unpleasant. Comparing scans of the students' brains in the two moods, the researchers found that sadness influenced more than just the emotion regulation circuitry. It led to increased activation in other brain regions, indicating that sadness was physiologically dialing up the pain. "We've made people anxious and threatened and fearful," Tracy says, "and we've shown that that makes the actual processing of those signals amplified." Strong medication would be needed to dull the pain after surgery for arthritis in her hand, Jo Cameron was informed by her anesthesiologist. But the 66-year-old Scottish woman doubted it. "I bet you any money I will not take any painkillers," she told him. The anesthesiologist looked at her as if she were not fully sane. He knew from experience that the post-operative pain was excruciating. When he came by to check on her after surgery, he was astonished to find that she hadn't requested so much as the mild analgesic he'd prescribed. "You haven't even taken paracetamol, have you?" he asked. "No," Cameron recalls having replied cheerfully. "I told you I wouldn't." Growing up, Cameron says, she was frequently surprised to discover bruises whose origins were a mystery. When she was 9, she broke her arm in a roller skating accident, but 3 days passed before her mother noticed that it was swollen and discolored. Years later, Cameron gave birth to her 2 children without any pain during delivery. "I don't really know what pain is," she says. "I see people in pain, and I see the grimace, the strain on their faces, and the stress, and I have none of that." Cameron's inability to sense physical hurt may be unremarkable to her, but it places her in a rarefied group of individuals who are helping scientists unravel the genetics underlying our ability to feel pain. Her amazed anesthesiologist put her in touch with James Cox, a geneticist at University College London. Cox and his colleagues studied her DNA and found she had 2 mutations in 2 neighboring genes, called FAAH and FAAH-out. They determined that the mutations reduce the breakdown of a neurotransmitter called anandamide, which helps provide pain relief. Cameron has an excess of the biochemical, insulating her against pain. Cox has been studying people like Cameron since he was a postdoc at Cambridge in the mid-2000s, when his supervisor, Jeffrey Woods, learned about a 10-year-old street performer in Pakistan who could walk barefoot over hot coals and stick daggers into his arms without so much as a whimper. The boy would earn money from these stunts and then go to the hospital to be treated for his wounds. He was never the subject of a study. He died from head injuries after falling off a roof while playing with friends, but Cox and his colleagues were able to analyze the DNA of 6 children from the same clan who showed similar insensitivity to pain. The children each had a mutation in a gene called SCN9A, known to be involved in pain signaling. The gene makes a protein that is instrumental in the transmission of pain messages from nociceptive neurons to the spinal cord. The protein, christened NaV1.7, sits on the surface of the neuron and serves as a channel for sodium ions to pass into the cell, which enables electrical impulses constituting the pain signal to propagate along the thread-like axon that connects to another neuron in the spinal cord. The mutations the researchers discovered in the SCN9A gene yield malformed versions of the NaV1.7 protein that don't allow sodium ions to pass into nociceptive neurons. With their nociceptors incapable of conducting pain signals, the children were oblivious when they chewed their tongues or scalded themselves. The beauty of working with these extremely rare families is that you can identify single genes which have the mutation and essentially are human-validated analgesic drug targets, Cox says. Mutations in the SCN9A gene are also linked to a rare condition called inherited erythromelalgia, or man-on-fire syndrome. Patients who have it face the extreme opposite of insensitivity to pain, a burning sensation on their hands, feet, and face. In warm surroundings or with slight exertion, the sensation gets unbearably intense, akin to holding one's hand over a flame. Pamela Costa, a 53-year-old clinical psychologist from Tacoma, Washington, who suffers from this syndrome, describes the pain as inescapable. To cope, she has her office temperature set at a chilly 60 degrees. She can sleep only with a complement of 4 fans around her bed and the air conditioning on at full blast. In an ironic similarity to individuals with pain insensitivity, the constant burning sometimes makes it hard for Costa to discern hot surfaces, which is how she burned her arm a year ago while ironing. "I didn't realize until I heard a hissing sound from my skin getting seared," she says. "It was the same sensation as I was already having." Stephen Waxman, a neurologist at Yale University School of Medicine and one of the world's foremost experts on nerve conduction, has studied Costa and others like her in his lab at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in New Haven, Connecticut. Gracious and affable, Waxman speaks animatedly and possesses a cheery disposition despite having made pain his life's work. He and his colleagues found, as another group had, that man-on-fire patients had mutations in their SCN9A gene. Those mutations have the opposite effect of the one in the pain-free kids from Pakistan, creating NaV1.7 channels that open too easily, allowing sodium ions to flood in even when they shouldn't. Through lab experiments conducted on neurons in petri dishes, Waxman and his colleagues proved that this was the mechanism by which the SCN9A mutations caused the syndrome in patients like Costa. "We were able to put the channel into pain-signaling neurons and cause them to go burp when they should be going bop-bop," says Waxman, referring to the hyperactivity that results from the unabated inflow of sodium ions. In patients with the syndrome, this defect causes nociceptors to bombard the brain with pain messages constantly. The discovery that NaV1.7 can open or close the floodgates to nociceptive pain signals has made the channel an attractive target for researchers looking to develop new pain medications that don't pose the risk of addiction that opioids do. Opioids work by binding to a protein on the surface of nerve cells called the mu opioid receptor, causing the receptor to communicate with proteins inside the cell. While the action of some of these proteins alleviates pain, the receptor's communication with other proteins results in pleasurable feelings. The body develops a tolerance to these drugs, meaning that higher and higher doses are required to trigger the sense of euphoria, which can cause addiction. Because NaV1.7 is present only in damage-sensing neurons, a drug that selectively turns off the channel promises to be an effective pain reliever. The sole known side effect is the loss of the sense of smell. Likewise, individuals with the mutation also can't smell. Existing local anesthetic drugs such as lidocaine indiscriminately block 9 sodium channels in the body, including ones that are key to an array of brain functions, which is why doctors must limit their use to numbing patients temporarily. Drug companies are searching for compounds that might be able to block NaV1.7 without disabling other sodium channels, but success has been elusive. Even so, Waxman is optimistic that the research eventually will lead to better drugs. I'm confident there will be a new and more effective class of medicines for pain that are not addictive, he says, his eyes brightening. Then he pauses for a moment and tempers his enthusiasm. But I can't attach a timeline. Now, we are going to come back to this article next week. They have some small blurbs in here about some people who are living with chronic pain. And let's read some of those. Hannah LeBoon, who suffers from pain in her jaw joints, watches the mesmerizing motion of jellyfish on a virtual reality headset in Luana Kalaka's lab. The scene, one of a series of relaxing marine images, is projected on the wall. Kalaka, who studies the neurobiology of pain at the University of Maryland, has established that VR that entertains patients eases their pain. Virtual reality has the unique capability, she said, of regulating body responses to pain, improving mood, and reducing anxiety. Let's see if there's another short one here. The relationship a patient has with a doctor can affect how much pain the patient feels, Napadao said, but we don't know why that is. To explore this phenomenon, Napadao simultaneously records the brain activity of an acupuncturist and a patient in separate functional magnetic resonance imaging machines. They communicate through a video feed while the patient is treated for experimentally applied pain. To relieve the discomfort, the clinician remotely triggers an electroacupuncture device attached to the leg of the patient. The monitor at right shows a scan used to map activity in the patient's brain. Next week, we will finish this article, A World of Pain. And I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well. Please come back next week. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.